This is Ralph Schoenemann for Taking Aim. We are back from 4 weeks in the West Bank and in Palestine. Maya and I have been away from you for 4 weeks, brothers and sisters, but we're very happy to be back with you now. And although Maya is in union meetings in San Francisco today, I'm going to be hosting what amounts to a call-in show so we can talk to you, brothers and sisters, about the realities on the ground in suffering Palestine, a shocking instance and example of a colonial system that has marked the population not merely for occupation and suppression, but for elimination. Let's talk about these issues. We'll talk about what actually exists on the ground, what's happening in Gaza, the meaning of these assaults in Lebanon, and the relationship between this and the U.S. imperial project for the region at large. So I hope to hear from you. Let's talk and discuss. Let's explore. 4 weeks is a long time to be away. We've missed being on Taking Aim, but we know the fund drive has been on, and we hope it's been as successful as it deserves to be. Brothers and sisters, call us. The number is 212-209-2900. Let's have a discussion today. I'm going to, by the way, indicate to you that when Maya and I went to the Palestinian camp of Deheshi, which is located in the area of Bethlehem known as Doha, the outskirts of Bethlehem, Deheshi has been one of the most militant centers of Palestinian resistance since the inception of the Zionist project. Many of the inhabitants of Deheshi, of course, are people who have been driven out. In fact, virtually all of them have been driven out of historical Palestine. And when we were last in Deheshi, Maya and I, it was 24 years ago. 24 years ago, when we had returned from the Palestinian camps in Lebanon, where we had been living on and off for 2 years, beginning with the Israeli occupation in 1982, and after the massacre at Sabra and Shatila in September of 1982, Maya and I came to Palestine, and in Deheshi we were living there and meeting with militants and talking about how next to move, what to do. And prepared there an international march on Jerusalem from all over Palestine under the demand an end to all occupation in Palestine. In the consequence of that march with international personalities, Maya and I were detained and arrested and expelled and actually banned. But now, 24 years later, we were back with our brothers and sisters and comrades in Palestine, and the situation on the ground, although I'm sure many of our listeners are aware to some extent of the oppression in Palestine, you have to experience it to understand the magnitude of it. Here you have a population that cannot move even 5 or 6 miles without encountering checkpoints where they can be held up and are held up for hours. If you want to travel from Bethlehem to Nablus, which is a trip that should take no more than 40 minutes, you can count on spending at least 5 hours. That's what happened with us. And our trip to Nablus to see the former mayor of Nablus, Bassam Shaka, an old friend and comrade, Bassam, whose legs were blown off by the Israelis, and who was subject to house arrest for many, many years. Bassam Shaka, one of the seminal figures of the Palestinian resistance. We were stopped at checkpoints, people held up for an hour and a half at a time. Young people getting out of their cars on demand are pushed and shoved to the ground, their belongings thrown and strewn about. You can be held up, you can be detained, you can be disappeared. It's completely at whim. Palestine today in the West Bank and Gaza is divided, well, in particular in the West Bank, is divided formally into so-called zones A, B, and C. In zone A, the Palestinian Authority is supposed to have full control. Of course, brothers and sisters, the Palestine Authority has no independent existence. It is funded entirely from afar. It is, in fact, under the operational direction of the Central Intelligence Agency. Its funds are at the discretion of the Israeli state as to whether they're allowed through or not. Its essential task is to function as a police person, a police operation for the Zionist occupation, whatever its protestations to the contrary. And in reality, on the ground, in the so-called areas of the A zone, which are supposedly under the authority of the Palestine Authority, the Israeli military raids on a constant basis. While we were in the Heshe camp, the military were out attacking two houses, which they surrounded with armored vehicles and began automatic rifle fire, seeking a teenager who was suspected of what? Of throwing a stone. The house was virtually riddled with bullets. The same thing happened on another night. It's a constant everyday event. In the so-called B zones, where Israeli forces and Palestinians are supposed to patrol, the Palestinian police or the Palestine Authority, it's only the Israelis who have the heavy armor. It's only the Israelis who exercise the day-to-day searches and raids and targeted assassinations and carry out a policy of armed attrition, driving the population into both isolation and a condition of economic immiseration. The land has been virtually entirely taken. 90% of the water is no longer available to the Palestinian population. In fact, the wall that you have read so much about and seen so much about, the wall is now a reality in all parts of the West Bank. You start with Jerusalem, you move along the roads, the highways are confined to the Israelis. The Palestinians are obligated to take back roads, virtual dirt roads, roads which are really only suitable for four-wheel drive vehicles at best. And then the Israelis put huge boulders in the midst of these roads so that passage is a very great obstacle race. So in reality, the West Bank has been carved up like a Swiss cheese. The land has been separated from the villages, and it is relentlessly encroached upon by vast settlements. The settlements loom. They loom like some sort of space odyssey, high into the sky, surrounding the Palestinian villages, and the land of the villages is confiscated as both a buffer zone and as an area for further expansion of the settlements in question. There is, in fact, no such thing as a peace plan for Palestine. There are only models of pacification that are imposed upon the Palestinian population. And in reality now, all wings of the Palestine Liberation Organization have been fatally compromised by their acceptance of the premise of a colonial settler state in 83% of Palestine on the chimerical idea that somehow some form of autonomy will be granted to the Palestinian population within the West Bank and Gaza. There is only there is one Palestinian population, 11.2 million people, 6 million people in diaspora, in far-spread areas of the Middle East, in camps that you read about all the time as under siege, no less than those in Palestine itself, 4 million in the West Bank and Gaza, 1.2 million inside the Green Line, that is the area of Israel that was occupied prior to 1967. And on the ground, Palestinians who seek to meet, who seek to organize, who seek to mobilize, are immediately deemed to be terrorists and are subject to targeted assassination and, above all, to being rounded up and disappeared. When we, Maya and I, were in Deheshi 24 years ago, meeting with people, organizing, many youngsters who were involved in those efforts were there to greet us again today, but with a very important distinction. Abdulrahman Al-Ahmar was 16 years old when we last saw him. He spent the next 17 years in prison. Mahmoud Safadi, 18 years in prison. Ali Dada, 17 years in prison. It's a story that can be told by every youth, by every family, by every village, by every inhabitation of the Palestinian population. Nobody is without the dead, the imprisoned, the injured, or the expelled. Call us, please, 212-209-2900. We want to hear from you. We want to talk about Palestine. We want to talk about the realities on the ground. One of the issues that was constantly before us during our stay in Palestine was, of course, the question that Lenin posed in 1903, what is to be done? And we met with groups of activists, 20, 30 at a time, in various parts of Palestine. And Maya and I gave talks at request at the University, Al-Quds University in Abu Dis, which is outside of Jerusalem. Al-Quds is the Arabic for Jerusalem, at Jerusalem University. We spoke at Bethlehem University. We spoke at Ibda, which is the cultural center in Bethlehem. We spoke on television in Bethlehem on Shepherd's TV with our brother Hamdi Faraj. Hamdi Faraj is the journalist who has been imprisoned many times and with whose family we have stayed in Deheshi. It's our second family. The discussions that we were engaged in with people centered on five basic principles. The first principle, which we were exploring together, is how in reality there is no form of national independence or self-determination that is compatible with a colonial settler state in any part of Palestine. Because what distinguishes the Zionist project in Palestine from other colonial operations and colonial movements, traditionally in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so on, is that the imperial and colonial powers, when they sought to colonize, were after cheap labor and the natural resources of the area that they sought to conquer. But what distinguishes that project from what has unfolded in Palestine is that from its inception, the Zionist movement projected the idea of removing the population and replacing it with a new settler population, thereby eliminating the Palestinians not only from their land, but from history. The organizing slogan was, "A land without a people, for a people without a land." And the consequence of that is that from the very inception of the Zionist colonization in Palestine, the project was to remove the villages and towns from the map, to wipe them off the map. And that indeed is what unfolded in the first 6 months before even the establishment of the state, the 6 months following the partitioning of Palestine over the heads of the Palestinian people. Something like 475 towns and villages were seized through a series of ethnic cleansing massacres from one end of the country to the other, from Hebron to the Galilee, as the Palestinians say, from Al-Khalil to Jalil. Some 800,000 people driven out of a population of 930,000. The remaining land confiscated and laws passed which required people to be able to demonstrate four generations of maternal Jewish descent in order to be entitled to live on or work the land. Many of us have been subjected to years of official propaganda about this plan and that plan, the peace plan of the Star Plan, the Yalong Plan, the Madrid negotiations, the Oslo negotiations. The realities are on the ground. Anthony Kuhn, in his study, Urban Planning in the West Bank under Military Occupation, written in April 1991, established that 60% of the West Bank had already been appropriated outright by 1991, and the bulk of the remainder subject, as he described it at the time, to blanket restrictions on use amounting to outright expropriation. Virtually all the land had been closed or requisitioned for military purposes, classified as state land, deemed abandoned property, and the latter phrase used for the facilitation of construction of settlements and roads, and then military outposts connecting the settlements. In fact, the road system that was built after 1967 totally integrated all the settlements in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem physically and economically, while fragmenting all existing Palestinian communities into isolated little ghettos. And out of the playbook of the Nazi operation in the Warsaw Ghetto itself, these vast, ominous, looming walls of 15 and 18 feet of concrete surround everything, cutting off the land, cutting off the villages, cutting off access, confining the Palestinians to a kind of permanent, ominous prison on the very ground that they depend upon for their food and for their survival. In fact, the Ministry of Agriculture and the World Zionist Organization had prepared already in April 1983 what was called Master Plan 2010, which projected 800,000 Zionist settlers covering the entire West Bank and, quote, isolating and hindering the growth of Palestinian population centers through strategic placement of road networks and a military presence. This is from a study by Merim Benvenisti called The West Bank and Gaza Atlas. And in Anthony Kuhn's report, as I've described it before, only 5% of the West Bank was deemed problematic for settlement. In other words, 95% of the West Bank had been earmarked for seizure in the 1980s. And indeed, as Newsweek reported 2 days before the Madrid conference wrote, it's too late for any land for peace deal on the West Bank. The settlement town of Ariel, which was recently a tent village settlement, has 5 public schools, a college, 32 kindergartens, 6 movie malls, tennis courts, soccer fields, shopping malls, a 102-room hotel, an industrial park with 75 factories producing everything from electronics to textiles. Its population will expand by tenfold by the year 2000. Here was what Deputy Mayor Yigal Rosenthal stated with respect to the surrounding countryside in the West Bank. You see these empty hills? We will cover them with homes and shops, the new geographical center of the State of Israel. And as Newsweek described it at the time, the settlements already in place on the occupied West Bank have rendered any Palestinian dream of statehood a total dream. It is impossible to drive for more than 5 minutes without encountering an expanding settlement, and the documentation proceeds. On the ground, the water is gone, the land is gone. Maya and I were in the village of Walaja, which is on the outskirts of Jerusalem, all the land seized. A little corner of the land on a mountain is being cultivated by the Palestinian villagers trying to keep the settlers and the Israeli army off it. By the way, in that particular ground is a memorial to Rachel Corrie, who died but a short distance away when she was taken as an object lesson by the Israelis, and the tank ran over her to break the will of the Solidarity Movement, youngsters who were coming to support the Palestinian population against the razing of their homes, the seizure of their ground, and the construction of the wall. On that very ground is a 5,000-year-old olive tree. The Japanese scientists were actually in the West Bank when we were there, studying that tree and having established by carbon dating and other means the antiquity of the tree. 5,000 years of age, trees like that have been uprooted across Palestine by the settlers. The military combs the hills and the valleys for land that belongs to Palestinian villages to eliminate their orange groves and their olive trees and to render the land barren and incapable of producing food preparatory to its additional seizure. So in actuality, the idea that there is some form of settlement that would allow a meager Bantustan on a fragment of Palestinian territory is a delusion and a fantasy. Many times people like Maya and myself, who for 40 years now have talked about the necessity for a call for a democratic and secular Palestine, for the de-Zionization of Palestine, for the replacement of a settler state in which rights are determined entirely on the basis of religious affiliation, to be replaced by a society in which citizenship and rights flow neither from ethnicity nor from religious affiliation. Many times when we have articulated this basic democratic 18th century principle, this premise has been labeled as utopian. What is utopian is the delusion that either U.S. imperialism or the Zionist colonial settler movement will in any way, shape, or form countenance any form of independence or national expression or national self-determination for the people of Palestine. Because this is part of an overall project for the retention of imperial control of the resources of the region. This is an essential element, the existence of a colonial settler state in Palestine, of keeping under thumb the Arab masses across every part of the region. And that is what the great Palestinian poet Rassan Kanafani, a leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, had addressed when he stated that the liberation of Palestine must proceed through Beirut and Amman and Cairo and Baghdad and Damascus and Riyadh. In short, there is no line of separation between the colonial and imperial exploitation and oppression of the Arab masses and the condition of the Palestinian population itself, brothers and sisters. Let's hear you, please.
Ralph.
Yes.
How you doing, Ralph?
Good. How are you?
Back. Very good. And God bless you. I'm agnostic, but hey, anyway.
Thank you, brother.
All right, brother. I hear Israel describe itself and also described in the mainstream media as a democracy, and I wonder if you have any insight on what other modern state has an ethno-religious determinant for citizenship that can be in any way defined as a democracy. Also, I wonder if you can expound on Dalan's role in the current situation. And I'm also very interested in the psychology of individual oppressors, and I wonder if you've had any individual experiences with the so-called IDF. And I'll take my answers off the air. And again, God bless you and keep up the great
work. Thank you, brother. Yes. Well, on the basic issue of the propaganda, of course, is constant in Western media that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East and so on. But of course, the representative institutions of the Zionist state, as you indicate, are exclusively allocated for the settler population. Because the premise is that the colonial settler state is exclusively a Jewish state, that rights flow from affiliation to a Jewish identity. And as I indicated, the land is under the laws of the Jewish National Fund, can only be worked and rented and lived upon if you can show that you have four generations of maternal Jewish blood. This sort of society is analogous to the colonial occupation by the French of Algeria or the South African European settlement and occupation for 450 years of South Africa. Has anybody who was in favor or supported the right to self-determination and national independence of a colonial population ever asked of the African population of South Africa that in order to be entitled to their national independence or self-determination on their own land, first they had to secure an exclusively apartheid settler state in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, or Durban? Did anyone say that to the people of Zimbabwe, what was southern Rhodesia? Before you have any right to national independence, there has to be an exclusive European state in Salisbury. Did anyone ask Kenneth Kaunda to guarantee a settler state and its security in Luanda, in Ndola, and Kitwe, in Zambia, northern Rhodesia? Was that the man made of the National Liberation Front of Algeria, of Ahmed Ben Bella? after 130 years of colonial occupation, did anyone say that if the Algerian people aspired to national independence, first they had to guarantee an exclusive French state in Algiers, in Oran, in Constantine? It's absurd. The very idea that a colonial settler population that conquers a population by force is to be deemed democratic because the settler population alone has the right of representation and involvement in a political process is, of course, a contradiction in terms. There is no meaning to calling a society democratic that conquers a population, drives it out, seizes its land, and excludes it from all political entitlement. So, no, the myth of Israeli democracy is precisely that. As to the role of Dahlan and of the security forces of the Palestinian population, these are figures who have been vetted and controlled and run by the Central Intelligence Agency. The basic issue for the Palestinian population today is that the Palestine Authority has been totally and fatally compromised. Not only is it completely corrupted by the funds that have been put in its hands, but its sole entitlement is to function as a policing agent on the ground. The Palestinian equivalent of the country-selling regimes that have been installed across the Middle East. Mubarak in Egypt runs a virtual dictatorship in Egypt. In essence, he is the pass-through instrument of imperial control in Egypt, a country in which the peasants have to sell their kidneys in order to have enough money to buy food. King Abdullah in Jordan, the same phenomenon. These are tiny little cliques and elites. They're what we call a comprador class, a country-selling regime. 70% of Jordan is Palestinian in population, a population that is to be found in the refugee camps where they were confined after they had been driven out of Palestine. And so it goes across the Arab East, and that is the basic role of the Palestine Authority today in all its formations. And as we speak, Israel is mounting airstrikes in Gaza as part of its drive to destroy Hamas and to completely decimate the Palestinian government, national unity government. In reality, the political spectrum of the Zionist state, whether the party of Kadima of the Prime Minister Ehud Olmert or the Labor Party with its defense minister Peretz, or the former leader of the Labor Party, General Ehud Barak, or Netanyahu of Likud, they all are in lockstep in targeting the population in Palestine, in West Bank, and in Gaza for unlimited airstrikes. The scale of death and injuries and damage sustained by the Palestinians in Gaza after 2 weeks of nonstop attack, with hundreds of injured women and children and buildings destroyed across this densely populated area of Gaza, is very eloquent in demonstrating what the real project is. The military forces of Israel, supported by all wings of the Zionist movement, have declared, as in the words of Olmert, there will be no limit in acting against the groups and those who are responsible for terror. What do they mean by terror? Any act of resistance. As Olmert declared, no one is immune. So helicopters and fighter planes supplied by the United States, precision missiles and weapons are carrying out saturation airstrikes across Gaza, and they are extending their policy of targeted assassinations to all political leaders, including the Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh, who is the leader of the political wing of Hamas. And how has he been described by Defense Minister Peretz and by Prime Minister Olmert, as a terrorist in a suit? In other words, the political wing of the formal organizations that are in place for the Palestinian population are designated as targets for assassination. Peretz's deputy, Ephraim Sneh, went even further. He said that the Palestinian prime minister will be a target for assassination. Quote, I put it like this. We don't care if he's a political leader or not. No one has immunity. There's no one inside their circle who will be immune from assassination or for a strike. What does political Hamas do? It gives operational approval to those who fight us. So therefore, the Zionist state has arrogated to itself the entitlement to murder any elected leader or any representative or any spokesperson for the Palestinian population.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
Brothers and sisters, the number to call is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Maya and I have just come back from a month in Palestine in the Middle East. We were also in Jordan and in Kuwait meeting with political activists because, as you're aware, there's a huge Palestinian population in Jordan and indeed in Kuwait. The Palestinian population were the engineers and the doctors and in diaspora, then driven out of Kuwait itself after the Gulf War. But let's hear from you at 212-209-2900.
Hello?
Yes, brother, please.
Oh, hi. Ralph, this is Fred. We had dinner several times when you were in New York last year.
Yes, Fred, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm glad you got away, but I'm happier that you're safely back in the
country.
Thank
you so much.
General question. As you put out last year, the Israeli-Lebanese war, having been started by this false situation with the Israeli tank being blown up inside the Lebanese border.
Right, in Ata El Shab village in the south of Lebanon.
Right, that was at least, 6 or 7 miles inside the...
right, exactly. It was a special forces raid by the IDF. In the village, and the tanks were blown up, and four Israelis were killed, and two were captured. And of course, the regime immediately spun this as a capture inside of Galilee. Not that that would be illegitimate, but it was a complete fabrication.
Of course, my question is: has there been? You've been out of the country, but has the media been any more accurate in this case than it's been in the past? I mean, you've had the luxury of seeing both the foreign and possibly our media.
Well, I mean, across the Arab world, if you watch television or Al Jazeera, the reports on the ground provide a very different reality than one can experience from American newspapers or Western reporting. I mean, to take the example of the Lebanese army siege of the Palestinian refugee camp of Nahabarid in outside of Tripoli, which is now in its 10th day, there's been a virtual saturation destruction of that densely populated refugee camp. And the Lebanese army has been provided with an armada of supplies of arms and ammunition. 8 planes arrived at Beirut International Airport since Friday. 4 U.S. transports, 2 from Jordan, 2 from the United Arab Emirates. They're preparing for the devastation of the Palestinian population in the camps. This is the opening shot. That's indeed what was the stated purpose of of Sharon and Begin back in 1982 at the time of the then-invasion of Lebanon, when Sharon announced that they would reduce the Palestinian population from 500,000 to 50,000 people in Lebanon. That's what's unfolding today. This small group of Fatah al-Islam, which is a Sunni group, is not even composed of Palestinians, is only the pretext for a long-planned operation. And 25,000 of the camp's officially registered 31,000 residents have already been driven out. And the conditions are utterly appalling for these, you know, serial refugees.
Right.
The people who are in Nahr al-Bared are people who were driven out of the south of Lebanon. And before that, they were driven out of Palestine. Now, UNRWA reports that they are being driven out of Nahr al-Bared. And as the UNRWA report states, the conditions are appalling. Those who have flooded into nearby Bedouin refugee camp, which was already overcrowded, are living 20 to a room, sleeping on the floors of mosques, in dirty courtyards under shelters. Everyone is filthy and exhausted. There is no water or sanitation. The UNRWA report describes families typical of the refugees camped in schools on dirty pallets. They haven't bathed in days. They haven't been given any food beyond a plastic bag of yogurt. 10,000 people, including elderly and disabled, remain inside the Nahr al-Bared camp. They are sick. They are without electricity or water or medicine or equipment. The report in the Financial Times, it stinks everywhere. Disease is spreading, and bodies are still under the destroyed houses. Do you read about this in the American press?
No, not at all. And the United Nations is not responding at all?
Well, here's the problem, I mean, with the United Nations. The United Nations is composed of countries whose governments have the same class structure as ours in the United States.
Understood.
So inevitably what the UN does on the ground is to implement the policies of its masters of imperialism.
Well, they can't even provide a corridor for the Red Cross or the Red Crescent to get in.
Well, let me describe to you what we experienced when we were in the Palestinian camp of Ain el-Helwa in 1982, which is a kind of emblem of what we're talking about. Ain el-Helwa, which means sweet spring, was the largest Palestinian camp in Lebanon. The population of Ain el-Helwa had all come from the Galilee. They were driven out by massacre in 1947 and 48.
Right.
And they settled in the area around Sidon, called Ain el-Helwa, which means sweet spring, in clusters which reflected the villages from which they'd been driven out. For the first 15 years, they were only allowed to live in tents. The Lebanese government, like that Lebanese government today, is a completely subordinate government to U.S. imperialism, denied the Palestinians any right to work or any social services or any social support. Those were only provided by the Palestine Liberation Organization. After 15 years, they were allowed to put up cinder block homes. And in 1982, the Israelis took Ain el-Helwa as a grid. They bombed it in quadrants, 10 nights and 10 days saturation bombing from the air, followed by another 10 nights and 10 days of bombardment from the mountains and the sea. And then, after the camp had been decimated, they brought in the bulldozers, and they leveled things. They even they plowed over the shelters where people were sheltering from the bombs and buried them alive, with family members clinging to the bulldozers. There was such a massacre in Ain el-Helwa that they had mass graves, and the mass graves in Ain el-Helwa created rivulets of body fluids that began to come to the surface like a stream and flowed across the camp until they entered the building of the International Committee for the Red Cross on the edge of Ain el-Helwa. The ICRC moved its offices, never said a mumbling word about what had unfolded in Ain el-Helwa. which was replicated in Rashadiya and Mia Mia and Al-Bas and Burj al-Barajni in camps across Lebanon. It's simply the little continuation now in Naha al-Barid. And it is a signal of what the Lebanese army is, an instrument of the government of Signora, which is a creature of the U.S., and they are targeting the Palestinian population once again as a prelude not only to going after the Palestinians across Lebanon, but for moving on to Syria as well. Even figures, conventional figures like Amal Saad Gurayeb, who was from the Carnegie Middle East Institute in Beirut, wrote in the British, in the London Sunday Herald, if this situation continues and the army continues to shell and to destroy civilian areas, there will be a domino effect across all the refugee camps. We will see this occurring in the camps across Lebanon. And it will be part of a wholesale war on the Palestinians. And that is indeed what's unfolding now in Lebanon as we speak. That's the reality. Please. Please.
Hello, yes. My name is Steve from New Jersey.
Yes, Steve.
I have a couple of questions, two very short questions, and one about fact, and one question about program.
Right.
The two questions are, one, is it true that over 20% of the Jewish Israeli population traces its lineage back to Muslim countries? Two, to what extent, if any, is there a Jewish Israeli working class? And the programmatic question is, if there is a Jewish working class in Israel, what kind of transitional demands can be made that would help bring them over in class struggle to join their Arab brethren and fight against the elite, which is 100% Jewish?
Thank you. I think those are excellent questions, and they are also questions of great political importance for any for any strategy for a revolutionary movement or a movement for a democratic Palestine. First, of course, the population, the settler population, the Jews who have come to Israel, close to 65% of the Jewish population in Israel are, in fact, from the Oriental Jews from the Arab countries, from Yemen and from North Africa and from Syria and Iraq and Egypt and so on. How they came to Israel is also important. Right after the occupation of Palestine unfolded in 1948, the Shin Bet, which is the secret police in Israel, and the Mossad, began a campaign in Iraq of bombing the synagogues across Iraq. The Iraqi Jews, which were a large population, were totally integrated within Iraqi society. They were civil servants, they were professionals, they were very important in the court of the king. They were wholly a part of the political, social, and economic life of the society, and never experienced the slightest discrimination, as is characteristically true of the Arab world at large with respect to its Jews, because Oriental Jews, or the Mizrahi, are basically Arabs who happen to have Jewish religious convictions. If you meet a Yemeni Jew, he looks like Jamal Abdel Nasser. He has the same clothing, wedding customs, food habits, mores, cultural attributes of a Muslim Arab or a Christian Arab. This isn't just a Yemeni Arab who happens to be of Jewish religious persuasions. And the Oriental Jews, or the Arab Jews in Israel, have always been wholly discriminated against by the Ashkenazi or European Jews.
They've also been among the far right in Israel, too.
Well, Yes and no.
At least certain portions of them. Let's say.
You see, of course, the game of divide and rule is always played in racist terms by any colonial settler state. These kids, when they go to school, the classic example was given to us by an American woman who took her child out of the school when he came back from an arithmetic class and was given a problem. You have 15 Arabs and you remove 10. How many are left? That was his problem in subtraction. So the point I'm making is that as soon as the population is brought there, they're subjected to the most intense racist propaganda about the Untermensch, who are the Palestinian and Arab population. But the Oriental Jews in Israel are something like 3% of the civil servants and 10% of the university graduates, although they're 65% of the population. In reality, on the ground, they are a quarter a step above the economic condition of their Palestinian brothers and sisters. So
there is a Jewish working class, then?
Yes, of course there is a Jewish working class. There is a settler working class that has the Histadrut, which is a trade union of the settler population.
I hate to call them a trade union, but I'll let you have that one.
Well, I mean, they are, of course, as you, I would agree, they're the trade union that caters so exclusively to the settler population. And as such, it is a racist trade union because it doesn't represent the indigenous
the
population.
The fascists had things they call trade unions, too, but they weren't part of the working class movement.
But there is a Jewish working class, and
there
are working class issues, of course. And indeed, on the basic question of how you address the settler population, how did the African National Congress address the settler population which had lived in South Africa for 450 years? How did the Algerians address the settler population that had lived in Algeria after the colonization of Algeria had unfolded 130 years before? They addressed them politically. They said, what future do you have being pitted against the survival needs of a continent of African people? Do you want to be associated with the architecture of a fascist state? Do you want to be in perpetual oppression and policing of the population here? Do you want to be pitted in a permanent war against the survival needs of this people? Is that a future for you? And with respect to the Jews in Palestine, it is the ultimate ghetto to be pitted against the aspirations and democratic desires of 400 million people. What future is there for this population except to be cannon fodder and perpetual massacre and colonial wars? So the Palestinian leadership has always been sensitive to this, although politically it has not addressed it as effectively as it could. But for example,
all of these groups that you're talking about were bourgeois nationalist groups that were supportable in their struggles, but they were not working class groups fighting for a socialist revolution, which I believe was on the agenda. Are there transitional demands that you believe that can bring the Arab working class and Jewish working class together in class struggle with the goal of not just overthrowing one elite to replace it by another, but overthrowing an elite to create a democratic communist Middle East?
Well, let's take these things a step at a time. First of all, when you speak about bourgeois
nationalism... Oh, two-state theory? Okay.
The bourgeois nationalist groups that you're describing in the Palestine Liberation Organization of both Fatah and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the first of George Habash and the second of Naif Hawatmi, which in some respect called themselves Marxist, as you say, they did not have a perspective for the social transformation of Palestine. And the basic and core question today, it's not just peculiar to Palestine, but in the age of imperialism, there is no way to achieve the democratic aims of national independence. The anti-colonial revolution cannot be accomplished except by the working class, by the mass of the population, having control over their economic life and of the means of production. Because if you fall short of that, and the national bourgeois movements that, as you describe them well, that are fighting nominally for independence find themselves in the position of having to administer the economy run by capitalists and imperialists from afar. Let's take the concrete example of South Africa. In South Africa today, all of the land that was in white settler hands remains there. 62% unemployment in South Africa today. The shanty town of Soweto, which had 2 million people in it under apartheid, now has 6.5 million people in it. The police force is the same apartheid police force with a veneer of black officers. As Malcolm used to say, this struggle is not about a black face in a high place. As long as Harry Oppenheimer owns the mines, blacks are going to be unemployed and in hunger in South Africa. You can integrate the beaches of Durban, but while the economic life of that society is concentrated in the hands of the same people who ran the apartheid regime and run out of the city of London, what does it mean to talk about the national liberation of a people? That is the heart of what Trotsky described as permanent revolution, that in the age of imperialism, the struggle for national independence, for self-determination, for the oppressed, cannot be realized except by getting control of the economic life of the country. And they say, what was the experience of the Cuban Revolution in 1959? All of the United Fruit and the sugar companies and the banks and the holding corporations owned the whole country of Cuba. So if Fidel Castro had satisfied himself with having office without power, which he was about to do, he went to New York in 1959 to meet with the rulers of the U.S. about increasing the sugar quota. But Che Guevara and the socialist wing of the July 26th said this is the road to being another agency of repression, except with a certain grace period of national legitimacy. And that is eminently true in Palestine, as you have indicated. The Palestine Liberation Organization, the Fatah of Yasser Arafat, was an apparatus in waiting, dependent upon the Saudi monarchy for its funds, and from King Hassan of Morocco. When you're talking to King Hassan of Morocco, you're dealing with the Mossad. And the fatal flaw was that the basic, elementary, democratic demand of a democratic and secular Palestine in which citizenship flowed from the living in a country and not from your ethnicity or religion, the basic premise of the Palestine Liberation Organization, was abandoned with this acceptance of the legitimacy of a colonial settler state in 83% of Palestine. You began by asking about the issue of what do you do about the settler population. You address them politically. You split them off from the colonial settler apparatus. The earlier caller asked me about the IDF. I didn't answer his question. When you go in, Maya and I went to Tenevot, which is a small Zionist settlement, Jewish settlement, if you like, near Tybee and the Triangle, which the Triangle is the area of the Palestine inside the Green Line, where there was a pocket of Palestinians that were not successfully driven out through massacre, and the Ibn Abalat, or Sons of the Land movement, took root in Tybee and Umm al-Fahim, and we went to see the well-known and courageous anti-Zionist figure in Israel, Akiva Or. Akiva, who is a dear friend, was a founder of Mutzpen, which means, Mutzpen means compass in Hebrew. This was the anti-Zionist organization which documented Zionist collaboration with the Nazis, which documented the role of the Shin Bet in attacking Jews across the Arab countries to create a climate of fear in which they would be induced to come to Israel. And Aki lives within 2 kilometers of Tulkarm, which he is not allowed to enter. But when you talk to kids who are in the IDF uniform, and you know every youngster in Israel is in permanent uniform, you can't talk to them 2 minutes before they tell you how much they hate being in uniform. All they think about is getting out of it. The population is fed up and exhausted with this endless, perpetual cycle of having to suppress the Palestinian population and go from one war to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, ad infinitum. This is a population that can be addressed politically, that must be addressed politically, because the great apparent power of the Israeli state is a phantom. I say that even though it's the fourth largest military power in the world, because it's completely dependent on U.S. imperialism subsidizing it. $100 billion in under 40 years, it comes to about $30,000 per Israeli citizen. This little outpost, this gangster outpost of U.S. imperialism in the region, has a shelf life as long as the stability of U.S. capitalism is maintained, and that's a very fragile instrument. Because we have $72 trillion of accumulated debt in the United States. And we have an economy that's addicted to arms production like an addict needs its fix in ever-increasing doses. And the U.S. imperial system is now engaged in a permanent series of wars of predation. This house of cards is going to collapse. Brothers and sisters, I'm sorry I didn't have more calls to respond to, but we'll pick it up next time. I thank the callers. They're right on target as to what is to be done. Yes, we need a struggle in Palestine that embraces the settler population, and it will. There is one Palestinian people. It is in struggle, and the struggle will ultimately lead to the liberation of the region. I'm convinced of that. Thank you so much for calling in. Maya and I will be back with you next week. And we'll continue with discussion about Palestine today and the struggle of the future.
Thank you very much, Ralph Schoenman, for this edition of Taking Aim. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, listener-supported, commercial-free community radio. Coming up next at 6 p.m. will be